Warm greetings. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is denied access to these practices and teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to help support this offering, you can go to my website, where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter. That's at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much, and enjoy. Most of you know, or many of you know, or I hope you know, that I always welcome topics for talks. If I haven't talked about something and you're interested in it, please ask me, because I also love digging and doing more research if it's something I haven't talked about for a while. And just recently in here, a student confessed to me that she was going to attend one of my longer weekend retreats, and she was a little afraid about being on retreat for that long, and she didn't know what to expect, so I thought I would address that tonight and just give a talk about what it's like to be on retreat. That being said, I'm actually a little reluctant to talk about being on retreat, because the idea when we go on retreat is to let go of all of our expectations. So it's a little hard to talk about what to expect, because I don't want to plant that in your head. Because the idea is really, you know, we're asked to plant a seed of intention. And those of you who have been on some of my retreats know that we start with honoring that spark of intention that brought us to the retreat. That moment when you said, I'm going to go on a retreat. You honor that intention, but you plant the seed, and then you let it unfold. You nurture the seed, you water it, you nurture it, but you don't dig the seed up, right? Whenever you plant a seed in a garden, same kind of idea when you're going on retreat, but you do plant that. And because we're letting go, we're being asked to let go of our expectation and control, of course there's going to be some fear in there, right? So there's many reasons why we get afraid sometimes when we're going on retreat, one of which is because we're in essence agreeing to put in many, many, many hours, maybe days, of quiet, intimate time with ourselves. And maybe we haven't wanted to talk to ourselves that much, right? You know, all the ways that, you know, we're in relationship with ourselves all day, but I would say a lot of time we don't really listen to ourselves, or you're arguing with ourselves, right? Having that kind of relationship where you're questioning yourself or arguing with yourself, so why would I want to go on retreat with this person and spend all this time? Another reason is that there's a great possibility of change, right? Maybe I'll change. Maybe something in my life will change. And even though we think we want that, there's some fear in that. And the Buddhist teachings say that if you really dig down, the biggest fear is change for us. We really don't want too much change because it's scary. It's something new. Okay, so we fear it. So whenever we go on retreat, there are two things to remember, okay? And it's both of these are qualities of heart and mind that I talk about frequently in here. You guys would probably recite these. But the two main ingredients when going on retreat are curiosity and kindness. Those two things. So you let go of your expectation and you go on retreat with a great, total, complete curiosity. I have no idea what's going to be here. Letting go, not trying to control retreat. And also a lot of kindness, because again, a lot of time what comes up for us in retreat, what we're confronted with, might be things that we've been avoiding that are difficult sometimes, which can be very transformative, but difficult. So we hold on to the, you know, curiosity, kindness about everything that comes up in retreat. And what I find is fascinating, it's usually the things that happen on retreat that end up being our practice. Okay, anybody been on a longer retreat with me? Isn't that true? Right? I just find this fascinating. So for instance, if, like I was saying last week, if it's noisy in some way on retreat and you're really adverse to sound, that's your practice, right? If somebody does something in the silence that's startling or annoying or unpleasant, or if you do something that you find is embarrassing or unskillful in some way, and your mind gets caught and hooked on that, that's your practice. It always is. So whatever attracts our attention on retreat usually ends up as our practice. So I'm always curious whenever I go on a long retreat, especially, what's going to be this time? So maybe it's the train. You don't know. I went on one retreat. It was a two-week private silent retreat, and they were doing construction on the roof. So the whole retreat was on the roof. That was my practice. You know how I am with sound. That was my practice. It was great because I learned so much on it. And the whole idea really is that everything, you have to look at retreat as everything is here. Every person, every situation, my own mind, everything is here to teach me. And we're in, you know, we're blessed on retreat with an abundance of rare, quiet time to just go very deeply inside and take a good look without any expectation of how it should be, and especially how we think we should be on retreat, okay? So for instance, if you go in with an expectation that everything's going to be blissful and pleasant, and you suddenly find yourself in tears about something, it's okay, you know? If you can stay with it, that experience is going to transform you. All of this being said, just about not having expectations, I really wish when I first started that someone had given me some of these suggestions about going on a retreat, because when I first started doing them, I really had no clue, and I did just about everything you could possibly do wrong. I did them. I used to write about meditation for national magazines. I wrote a story about one of my retreats where I just did everything wrong, and it's a big list. It's too embarrassing to go into today, but I'll give you part of it. So on one of my first residential overnight, you know, weekend retreats, it was at a Buddhist monastery, and you know, I was in my mid-20s, and I was with my now husband, Brent, who came with me, used to come with me on retreat a lot. And when I studied at Naropa University, I had the great opportunity to do day-long retreats with the monks and the nuns. So I kind of got plunked into that. But it was a very safe environment. It was at school. There were other people doing it from school. And this was the first, and I'd been on some lay retreats, which means they weren't monastic retreats. And so there's so many more rules and things you're kind of not supposed to do in a way when you go to a monastery. Okay, it's very different. And so because the way to get to this monastery is very windy roads, long travel, Brent and I kind of got lost, and so we showed up late, a little late, after everything had already started. And the woman there kindly greeted us and informed me that I would be sleeping in a cootie hut. It was the middle of winter. Does anybody know what a cootie hut is? Okay. They are basically, the monks usually build them themselves, and they're like a closet on stilts. They're homes that they built, but they're little huts, and they have no heating except for like a propane heater, so you have to keep the window kind of cracked. And they have this wooden bed, and the pad is about this big. You're just basically, you're camping, essentially, in a little thing. And I usually sleep with a wool hat, wool socks, full pajamas in the summer, because the air conditioning's on. I get cold. So I was going to be in a cootie hut, and I was not happy about it. And my husband was told that he would be sleeping with 6 to 8 other men in this 3 or 4 bunk bed area where everyone's kind of stacked up on top of one another. And if any of you know my husband, he's a bit of a hermit. And we were both young men and, again, had absolutely no idea what to expect. Maybe, you know, the Holiday Inn or something, which, like, what? We're staying where? Really kind of arrogant about it. And this is so embarrassing. And by the way, no retreat is like that. No retreat is a Holiday Inn, right? You're always, it's like, you're on retreat. But we didn't know that. So, and they aren't all bunk beds and cootie huts either. But anyway, we were young and we were just, I think, newly married then or dating. And we were going down this long hallway walk down there, you'll find the meditation hall. And so we were complaining loudly. And Brent was, we were kind of shoving each other, like, I gotta sleep in a cootie hut, you know? And he's like, yeah, I gotta sleep with a bunch of men farting and snoring all night, you know? And he was pushing me, and I banged into this window, and I almost broke it. And I'm like, my God, you know? So we're making such a fuss, and right in front of us, at the end of the hallway, were the monks and like 60 meditators who had just heard us listen to this entire conversation that we just had. Yeah. Yeah, so that was a whole weekend. And I told you, I wrote a story about this. There were many, many more embarrassing, horrifying moments on that retreat. And I don't have time to go into them here. It'd be the whole talk. But what I really want to share about that is that it actually ended up being, I recall it very vividly, even with all the embarrassing, horrible moments, it ended up being a really beautiful, transformative retreat at the end. And the monks treated us so kindly. They were not, oh my gosh, you did it wrong, or what. They were so kind to us and forgiving. They really forgave us for not knowing. And you know, that's how we learned. And over the years, we actually ended up going back to that monastery many, many times, and we always felt so welcomed whenever we visited. The monks were so kind. And I'm offering that story up to just let you know that whatever you do on retreat is really okay. It's really okay. It's how we learn. Okay? You're not expected to know everything on your first retreat, you know? So don't give yourself that extra added, oh my gosh, I'm going to do it wrong, and I can't do anything wrong. I got to be perfect on this. Throw that out. The teachers, all the retreats I've ever gone to, the teachers will continue to guide you in loving kindness and compassion. Just a continuing thread through the whole retreat. So after a while, it becomes really difficult to continue to be unkind to yourself and also to all the others who are practicing with you. You know, because there's that reminder, kindness, kindness, compassion, compassion, constantly. And it becomes really difficult, especially after a while, a longer retreat. There's a sense on retreat, especially the longer ones, of just being held. You know, the teachers hold the space. And the rest of the practitioners are also advised. You're advised to support one another. So it becomes this just this really nice feeling of being held. In fact, on almost every retreat, residential retreat, day-long retreats, but residential retreats especially when there's longer time together, there's always, it never fails, there's always a sense, a great sense of connection and a feeling of oneness at the end of the retreat, okay? And this is because what happens is on retreat, what we're doing is letting go and of clinging, and what we're letting go of clinging to is our ego, our sense of self, a sense of a separate self. So it's like the onion layers start coming off, they start being peeled. And a lot of times, most of the time at the end of the retreat, we've been sitting together in silence for 3 days, and there's tears, and there's hugging, and there's a sense of connection. Of course, it lasts for about 1 or 2 weeks after retreat, and everybody coalesces back into their little self, right? But you get a sense of it, you get a taste of it. I don't think it ever kind of coalesces totally back to what it was, but you get a sense of that spaciousness, letting go of, it's just me, okay? Show of hands, how many people have been on a day-long retreat? With me? Yes? Most of you? What about a residential retreat? Awesome, okay. So those of you who haven't tried a residential retreat, I'm going to encourage you to try one, okay? You know, I promise you, you can do it. I promise you, you can do it. A lot of times after retreat, when we're doing question and follow-up, a lot of times almost always actually, students will say, how do we keep going? How do we keep the practice going? How do we deepen the practice? And what I always tell them is that retreats are really crucial for this, for keeping up the practice. And through the years, this has absolutely been essential for me, for going on retreat. In fact, my own daily practice, in essence, sort of becomes a maintenance, a little bit of a deepening, but a maintenance between retreats. And then on retreat, it's like, I go deep, and my practice changes. And then it's maintenance for that. And then it goes deeper again, okay? And it's always different. Sometimes retreats are like states of bliss, and sometimes they're really difficult and agonizing, and sometimes they're a mix of that, but they're always transformative. There are many reasons why retreats are so important, but again, the first is that it's such an incredibly powerful experience to be in silence with yourself, even if it's just for a day, for 7 hours, you know. It gives us this kind of rare, precious time to sense what it's like, to really go deep into that silence for that long with ourselves, to get that experience of being that quiet on purpose, consciously taking a look inside, not just being quiet and doing your chores, right? It's consciously nurturing that sense of awareness and stillness. Such a precious time to get in touch with, be intimate with your own mind, heart, body. It's like going on a weekend date, you know, with yourself. It's also incredibly beneficial to be guided by a skilled and experienced teacher or teachers, and to learn from them, have them guide you in seeing things differently, seeing yourself differently, and experiencing your practice differently, you know. When I find a teacher I like, I usually follow them for a while, many, many years, but it's also really beneficial to find other, you know, find other teachers that speak to you so that you can learn something different. I always learn something different from new teachers. You know, unlike listening to a talk online about it or reading about it, being on a retreat provides you with a very personal, experiential, more permanent learning experience, because you're learning in the silence, right? You're experiencing it directly in that moment, in that silence. And you're opening, you know, they say meditation, whenever I teach the MBSR workshops, we do the meditation first. I do the talk after our meditation here, because the mind is more open to receiving and absorbing it than if we did it before the sit, okay? And with retreat, you're really deep in, you're in silence. There's so much experience there, your own experience, and your own learning. On longer retreats, you're also able to spend a little one-on-one time with the teacher, usually about, so it's a five-day or a weekday, or a week-long or longer. Usually that week you get to spend about 15 minutes, which is quite a bit of time, actually, with one-on-one with the teacher to ask questions. And there's also hour-long, smaller group sessions with between 8 and 12 people. So one teacher will talk, and you get the benefit of asking and having that experience. But also, it's great to listen to all the answers that the teacher gives to their students, okay? So, just to say again, I have never, ever in my life been, and I've been doing this 25 years, I have never been on a single retreat where I've not felt incredibly changed by it when I have left the retreat. And I have a deeper understanding of myself, my practice, and I always come away with more kindness and compassion for myself. That's kind of the fun part. Like, I'm nicer to myself every time I leave retreat. And as I've said in here again, the most challenging retreats sometimes are the most transformative. So instead of being afraid of this, I like to bow to it. Thank you. It's hard to do in the moment, but it's like, is it really hard? Thank you, you know? Because I know it's your most intense teacher, the most difficult ones. As an encouragement, it might be helpful for you to know. I thought this was interesting. This is in a study that was published just this year. Researchers discovered or found that about 200 participants who attended a one-week Vipassana retreat showed marked improvements in mindfulness, anxiety, depression, and dysfunctional attitudes such as brooding. The researchers also reported an association between the number of meditation retreats participants completed in the previous year and greater mindfulness overall and lower levels of dysfunctional attitudes. Yeah. So with all of that being said, I am going to give you just a few practical suggestions that can be so helpful to keep in mind whenever you go on retreat. So one of the first things I want to talk about that is sometimes so difficult for people is what is called noble silence, the practice of noble silence, which is so much more than just about not speaking. Right? People say, oh, can I be quiet for that long? Noble silence is very nuanced. It doesn't just involve no speaking. Among other things, it involves bringing an intention of silence to all of your experiences, consciously eliminating distractions so that you can better focus on the present moment and attend to whatever's arising. So the whole idea on retreat is that there's never really a break in the mindfulness practice. Okay? It's about continuing to deepen the silence, getting really familiar with that space of silence, which as we continue on retreat just gets richer and deeper with each hour, each day that it goes. And I won't go into it here tonight because of time, but this is also why when we're on retreat, we practice walking meditation and mindful eating, because we need to move our bodies and we need to eat, right? And we need to shower and do all of those other things. But the practice has been set up so that even these things are done in a way that allows us to practice deepening our awareness in the silence. And you can honor noble silence in many ways. And the first one that is so difficult for people is no eye contact, which I mention on every retreat that I still struggle with that because I want to smile at everybody. It's also helpful to know that even today, and I try to help students with this by saying that I do it too, is that it's really not a hard and fast rule. You're going to make eye contact. You're going to smile. It's what we do. It's just the intention of, can I let people have their space? Can I make that effort? But don't go crazy with that, because that will get, control. I can't look. And, you know, you can make yourself crazy with that too. It's just an offering to help us, everybody, sink more deeply in the silence. Because first of all, we're giving ourselves permission to take off the social mask, okay? So you don't have to have this blissful smile, friendly smile on your face. You can be sad, you know? You can be however you are, and it's okay. The social mask is a communication. Every facial expression is a communication. It's a way of communicating. So that's eliminated. You don't have to smile at everybody that's passing you. It's a relief, especially on a retreat for a week. My God, it gets really exhausting to have to smile at everybody for that long, right? Sometimes if you look closer, you might discover that what you're looking for when you're attempting to communicate with the eyes is an affirmation from others that all is well. All is well with yourself. Am I okay? Am I doing okay? Am I doing okay? Are you doing okay? I know for me, that's just to confess. I worry about my students, so I want to check everybody out and see if they're doing okay. And I don't know. They're not speaking, so I'm not going to know. But I still try. So if you're having trouble with this, it's really skillful. Someone told me this early on, and it helps to look at people's feet. And maybe even in your mind, go feet, 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 feet. And look at people's feet. On retreat, we're also agreeing to practice noble silence for one another because we want to honor each person's individual process, which is going to be completely varied again. So, for instance, you might be feeling really blissful while other people might be experiencing a deep pain at that moment, or vice versa. And often you can feel the whole range of emotions in one day. But if you're making eye contact and there's an exchange of I'm feeling blissful and the other person's feeling deep pain, there's going to be a disconnect and maybe even some hurt or misunderstanding, which is why we give each other space. It's also helpful to remember that during a retreat, there are almost always, unless you go on a retreat for more advanced practitioners or something, most retreats, almost all retreats, have a mix, even if you're on a week-long retreat or longer, of people who are brand new and people who are experienced and people in the middle. So don't feel like you're all alone. If you're a beginner and you haven't done it before, you're not alone. Okay? There's a lot of people that are also going to be on retreat at different levels. The other thing to remember is that everyone, when they're sitting in silence with their eyes closed, tend to look really peaceful and blissful. You know, many are likely going to be lost in deep thought, encountering some challenging emotion or old stories, but it's not going to show on their face, so you're not going to know. And that's helpful to remember when, you know, sometimes we can be sitting there struggling, thinking, I'm the only one. You look around, like, I'm the only one who's fill in the blank, right? I'm the only one. And that's just not, I'm not doing it right. I'm opening my eyes and everybody has their eyes closed. What's going on? I'm not doing it right. Okay? So I want you to let go of that idea again. So another way we can help maintain noble silence is maintaining verbal silence, of course. And we do this by making a really strong effort, mindful effort, not to whisper to another yogi, comment, ask a question, especially if you're rooming with someone. Anybody have trouble with that when you're rooming with somebody? Those of you who've been on retreat? Yeah, it's hard. Because it's like, okay, here we are in our little room and we're together and we can talk now. You know, I'm whispering down the hallway sometimes when I'm teaching retreat. On retreat, you can write private notes to the teachers and the managers on a bulletin board. So there's really no need to, you know, feel fearful about maybe being alone. The teachers are very aware and very on paying attention to, and will pick up your note right away and read it and get back to you. And one of the reasons that we don't talk to each other, many, many obvious reasons, but take a notice. It's good to take a notice of when you want to ask a question or when you feel it's really necessary to speak, and ask yourself, question yourself, why? Why do I need to do this right now? Why do I need to ask this question? Some of you may have heard me share this story before, but on retreat several years ago, about day three or so, this woman who seemed kind of new walked up to me while I was at the tea counter. And it was a week-long retreat, and I wasn't leading it, but I had led some of the practice leaders, so I've been up there leading some of the silent sits. So I figured she was going to ask me a question because I seemed like I was one of the people who was leading the retreat or something. So I agreed. I kind of looked at her, you know, made eye contact. And her question to me was, are you going to have a baby? Don't ask that question. So I just kind of shook my head like, I took it for what it was and I kind of chuckled about it. But if I was really, really sensitive about that, that could be so painful, and that would be the rest of my retreat. That's it. That's the rest of my retreat, and I'm thinking about it and doing all this stuff. So, gosh, you never know. She might have thought, like, gosh, this is going to be a joyful moment, and she's going to say yes, and I can share that with her, whatever. I don't know why she asked that question at that moment during a silent retreat. So... Another way that we can work to maintain noble silence is being mindful of our physical presence in the silence. So this means we make a strong effort not to communicate or distract through our expressions again or our body language. So just to say, silent miming is still communicating, right? That's still communicating. We also refrain from physically touching or comforting someone if they seem upset. This is a hard one for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to let that person have their process. And please know that all yogis, including yourself, can ask for the support of the teachers or the managers, again, with written notes. You can, even if you're having a hard time, write a teacher a note and say, can you meet me for 10 minutes? Or I'm struggling, can we talk? Or something along those lines. So, you know, it's really best to let whoever might be crying or look upset, just let them be. It's really a hard one because we all want to come over and give a hug or something. We're also asked on retreat to refrain from reading, writing, or internet use. And this one's a hard one for people as well. But our goal is to get more deeply in touch with our own bodies, emotions, and thoughts. And listening to or reading the words of others, or even the writing that you're writing down in your own journal, is really going to be a serious distraction that can take you away from your direct experience. This is especially true with email, and this is difficult, especially if you're on a week-long retreat, and it can be an excellent practice to see where we're kind of hooked on or addicted to our internet. It's also super easy to want to do this in the privacy of your own room if you have a cell phone, and those of us who have done it have experienced it and tried it, you're going to be cheating yourself big time if you do it. You think that you're, oh, I'm cheating and I'm kind of getting away with it, but who you're cheating is yourself, because it's totally going to distract you. Here's a really good explanation of this that I like from a long-time practitioner who wrote, the problem with writing in a journal, I was talking about writing in a journal distracting. The problem with writing in a journal during a deep retreat is that it pulls your mind out of the non-discursive, non-conceptual state that you've cultivated by meditating all day and keeping complete silence. One of the goals of retreat is to quiet the chattiness of your mind and become more open to non-conceptual understanding. Writing down your experiences in a journal works against this and draws you back into a discursive and conceptual way of thinking. I really liked that explanation. So, another way that we can honor noble silence on retreat is by our choice of clothing. And in this case, the best look while on retreat usually involves wearing really loose, quiet, soundless, non-revealing, neutral-colored attire. And we do this because it's really unfair, in many ways, to draw attention away from, for other people's attention away from themselves and onto you. Okay, so, you know, if you have some bright pink t-shirt that has your yoga, the name of your yoga studio on it, it might seem really simple, but that's going to constantly take your eye away. It's like just a little distracting. The only time that I was really glad that somebody wore a t-shirt that had words on it was on another week-long retreat, and it was about day 3 or 4, and it was in the morning, and I was in the breakfast line, and I was cold, and I was tired, and I was hungry, so I was grouchy, and I was just standing there, and the line wasn't moving that long, and it was just, ugh. And the guy in front of me had a t-shirt on with the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, and this is where I learned those words, was this guy's t-shirt. He had the words were, this is it. This is it. And I was like, oh, thank you. Just made me so happy. And I met him afterwards. You know, we talk at lunch when the retreat ends, and I thanked him, and you know, he told me that was from Thich Nhat Hanh. We had that discussion, and I use that all the time now. So that was the only time, but otherwise don't do it. So practicing noble silence as you move your body can also be a great mindfulness practice too. The way I like to do it on retreat is to make a game out of it and pretend that I'm a ghost. I don't want people to see me or hear me or know that I'm there. I just want to kind of be there around them. And so I try to see how quiet I can be. If I were a ghost, would I slam the door if I didn't want them to see me? Or how would I put my utensils in the utensil area? I put them really slowly. I walk really slowly. So I try to pretend like I'm a ghost. I really don't want to be seen. And how quiet can I be? So just finally, with all of these things, whenever we're practicing noble silence, what we're not doing is expecting ourselves to be perfect in any way or using it as a chance to beat ourselves up for not doing it right, right? If we're making some kind of noise or something, or if we do something unskillful, you know. We are also not doing it in an attempt to reach some advanced or ideal state, to be the perfect meditator, right? This kind of thinking also just causes us a lot of stress and frustration, because we really can't ever do it perfectly. So it's really helpful to always apply a bit of humor to your sit. You know, whenever you find yourself creating a kind of pumped up identity that says things like, "Whew, look at me, I'm such a great meditator. I'm almost there. Two more days and I'll find enlightenment," you know. Just to also finally say, it's really important to remember we're not trying to clear our minds of all thought or solve some big issue that we've been struggling with, either presently or in the past. A lot of people will come to retreat saying, "This is what I'm struggling with. This is what I'm going to work on retreat." And actually, honestly, it almost never works out that way, to be truthful. Again, we plant that seed of intention, but what's going to show up is going to be what shows up. And if you're wanting to figure it out, a big problem, that's a kind of resistance, isn't it? I don't want this, so let me figure out how to fix it. And that's not how we go into retreat. Finally, as the retreat is winding down, usually the thoughts go from, how am I ever going to get through X many number of days of this, to, oh my God, do I have to leave and go back into the real world, right? Most of the time, your teacher or teachers are going to help you, give you some suggestions about how to continue to process the retreat. But again, the most important suggestion on ending retreat is the same one at the beginning, which is not to have any expectation about how it's going to unfold, which is kind of interesting, because the retreat isn't, when you leave retreat, it hasn't ended. Most of you have gone on retreat know this. It continues to unfold for many weeks or months sometimes, and things will just come up. And so that also is a chance for you to practice letting go and just being there in the moment and not having expectations of how it should be, okay? So I think that we're out of time, but what I would like to do maybe is just open it up just a couple minutes in the end, to see if anybody has any questions or thoughts, maybe just 5 minutes, since I said I would do that.
Can I add just a little?
Yeah.
My experience of going in completely clueless and knowing absolutely nothing of what I want to do, right? I set my attention, that kind of stuff. But there's a couple of helpful things that I found. Take a tissue with you when you go, because you never know when I completely got caught off guard. And had a complete meltdown with snot running everywhere and nowhere for it to go and that kind of thing, and really needed a tissue and I didn't have one. So just a little thing like that, that it may happen. I mean, I'm personally, I need to be prepared for everything that could happen, and I got caught off guard with that.
Yeah, bring tissue. And just to say, crying is okay. It's actually expected. There's a quote, and can't remember who said it, but unless you've wept during meditation, you haven't begun to meditate. You haven't started to meditate. So crying is good. It's a good release. Anybody else want to have any thoughts about that before we end? Elaine?
Along with what Kathy was asking, any other thoughts about a longer retreat and important things to bring?
Yeah. Elaine's going on the 5-day retreat in July with me.
Earplugs.
Earplugs are really good. The wax ones, those are really good to have.
For sleeping.
Yeah. For people who get cold, just so you can regulate. They're usually regulated, but you know, layers for clothing. I bring a heating blanket to put under me, just in case it's freezing and I can't sleep. What else? Really quiet shoes. Clogs are great with the cork on the bottom of them. Test your shoes. Honestly, test your shoes before you go, because I've gone on a retreat before and, oh, these will work, and I'll put them, throw them in my suitcase, and I get them on, and they're like, you know, that make that sound. And then I'm embarrassed and I don't have any other shoes. So, yeah, good shoes can help.
I always take new locks. Always just, you know.
Yeah. Most retreat centers have, like, the medicine cabinets. You can go find those kind of things. They have extras, but that's, yeah, that's a good one.
Towels, extra socks, handkerchief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I usually, for the 5-day, maybe I'll send you my suggestions, if anybody would like them. Usually I send out a list of those kind of things to bring. Yeah, special diets, they usually ask you. Some retreats you're going to have to kind of wing it. The ones that I do, like the women's retreat, they do all special. I get a list of who's gluten-free, who's dairy-free, who's XYZ, and they usually do a good job. But it's always good to also, there's usually a refrigerator at the retreat, and you can bring your own supplemental things. Your medication's good to bring. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good questions. Anybody else questions? Practical questions about retreat? Okay, awesome. So let's just settle for 2 minutes just to end. Just take a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. Just maybe place one hand on the heart, one on the belly. Breathing into the fingers. Maybe just for a moment, see if you can connect to the essence of retreat, which is to connect with everyone on retreat in that silence. So, such a beautiful night tonight with Sangha members, all regular members of Sangha. It's such a treat. It's such a beautiful group of people. Maybe see if you can connect to that energy of silence and that connection with each other. This is your Sangha. See if you can sense that support for one another. And that sense of unity. See if you can connect to that for a moment, right from the heart. Might even send out a sense of gratitude for each person for creating the Sangha. You all create the Sangha, each one. Feel yourself connected. And sending out these words to one another. May we all nurture gratitude, grace, and ease in our lives. May we all be secure and grounded. May we all be happily and successfully contributing. May we all be kind and compassionate to ourselves and to each other. May we all, including this beautiful planet, be healthy and free from both internal and external harm. May the fruits of our practice benefit all beings everywhere without exception. May it be so. Namaste, everybody. Have a great week. Namaste.